They carried it out in a very tight time frame under some very challenging conditions.
The Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline opens after a weekend shutdown. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 17th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a massive arrest in South Central, net gang members.
Our special assignment unit was heavily involved along with our vice unit, so a lot of manpower went into this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
Governor Sean Parnell today presented a plan to make minor changes in the state's oil tax that he says would spur development and create more jobs in new fields. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Governor Parnell says the current tax structure that was passed in 2007 has been effective in improving the state's revenue. However, he adds that the condition of the oil industry has changed, and it needs incentives now to increase production.
Given the global recession that overtook us and declining job opportunities now in the oil patch, even with declining oil production, we need to do more now than before. We need to do more than just grow the state's savings accounts. It's not about growing our government, it's about growing our economy. Adjustments can be made that will be beneficial to the people of this state over the next several decades.
The plan is similar to a bill already introduced in the House of Representatives for consideration this year. It would bracket what's called the progressivity tax. That's a surtax on oil selling at more than $30 a barrel. It's set at rates that increase as oil prices go higher. Those brackets would work like the federal income tax system, where the tax rate changes depending on how much money the taxpayer makes. Parnell says the new bracket method would result in a lower effective tax. His plan would also cap that progressivity tax and give more different tax credits within existing fields and in completely new fields. The state would get less money for its oil, with initial estimates showing a first-year revenue decline of $382 million. But Parnell says he prefers to look at the alternative, more jobs in Alaska.
It's clear that our resources are competing in a global market, and in the long term, this reduction will make the state of Alaska a more desirable place to invest, a greater magnet for those Alaska jobs that we need, and will keep oil flowing in the pipeline for years to come.
Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker, who sponsored the bill now in the House of Representatives this year, welcomes the governor's joining the legislative debate on the state's tax policy. He calls it an alignment with how he and other legislators want to improve the state's investment climate.
It's a very important mechanical change. I'm very, very encouraged to see the governor agreeing, because that in and of itself, brings the state of Alaska into a much more competitive situation on an international basis.
There are differences in the details between the Parnell and Hawker plans. As an example, Hawker would give a flat reduction in the base tax on oil from 25% to 20%. Parnell would keep the current rate for fields now in production, but would cut the base to 15% on new development. Hawker says he sees a willingness to reach an agreement on that point, however. Opponents, including Democrats, have been skeptical about the need for changing the tax at all, and they question whether the state will ever see the returns expected. Both Hawker's and the governor's bills will be formally read into the record after the session begins. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Oil is flowing again through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Workers labored through the night to install bypass piping at Pump Station 1. That work was completed early this morning, and the pipeline restarted just after 10 a.m. Katie Pesnecker is a spokesperson with the Joint Information Center in Fairbanks. She says things went well overnight, even though the operation took a little longer than expected.
It was a very complicated process. It was a very complicated project. This is the sort of engineering project that we would normally take months to plan, and they carried it out in a very tight time frame under some very challenging conditions. So very happy with how things turned out.
The target goal for the next 24 hours is to bring the pipeline up to 500,000 barrels a day. Before the leak was discovered more than a week ago, the pipeline was carrying about 630,000 barrels a day. Last week, an interagency enforcement sweep in Anchorage and the Mat-Su Valley netted 45 criminals, plus guns, snow machines, a pair of marijuana growing operations, and a runaway. KSKA's Len Anderson has the details.
Anchorage police described the three-day operation as the largest of its kind to take place in Alaska. Altogether, Operation Gangbusters involved more than 100 sworn officers from 12 federal, state, and local jurisdictions. According to Anchorage Police spokeswoman Anita Shell, a lot of advance work went into last week's Wednesday through Friday arrests and seizures.
Just from the Anchorage Police Department's level of participation, there was weeks and weeks of advanced planning on this. Our special assignment unit was heavily involved along with our vice unit, so a lot of manpower went into this.
The overall goal was to reduce violent crime in Anchorage and the Mat-Su by arresting people who were likely to commit such acts. The teams used the state's list of outstanding felony warrants. Shell says that list contains about 2,000 names.
It's an Excel spreadsheet of people who are wanted for a variety of different things. And so that was some of the intelligence that they gathered, was the list of wanted felons, and picked the cream of the crop, if you will, the top felony warrants that were out there, and just went after them, just focused mainly on that.
That targeted focus produced 45 warrant arrests covering a pretty broad felony range.
They were mainly narcotics and gang type of offenders, but the warrant arrests range anything from sex offenders to failure to comply, conditions of release, all the way across the board.
The officers say they also collected a great deal of street crime intelligence involving such things as narcotic sales and gang activities. Besides those arrests, the sweep also recovered one runaway, two stolen guns, two stolen snow machines, a methamphetamine dealer bust, and two marijuana growing operations. Shell says that the size of the operation and the number of arrests could lessen community crime in the immediate future.
When you take some key players out of their roles, you may end up with some people, you know, not dealing drugs, having difficulty finding their drugs because their supplier may have been put in jail over the weekends. Yeah, you may have some people laying low. You may have some desperate people out there, though, too.
The officers involved were with the U.S. Marshals Service, Homeland Security Investigators, Federal Bureau of Investigations, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, U.S. Probation and Pretrial Services System, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska State Troopers, Alaska Department of Corrections, and the Anchorage, Wasilla, and Palmer Police Departments. Shell said each of the teams contained various combinations of the participating agencies, with each team working at least 10 hours a day over the 3 days. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, donning a mask is a dark tradition at the end of Russian Christmas.
I just met a guy who made some eyes, nose, big goatee, big beard, some brownish hair, and that's pretty much it.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are home heating costs more than you can manage? If you're living on a fixed income or reduced income, the Heating Assistance Program may be able to help. To obtain more information or an application form, visit the Heating Assistance Program website at heatinghelp.alaska.gov or call 1-800-470-3058. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
As Congress prepares to battle over the newly enacted health care reform law, Alaskan health care professionals and reform advocates are working to highlight what they see as the benefits of the federal overhaul. At a forum sponsored by the Alaska Public Health Association last week in Anchorage, AARP Advocacy Director Pat Luby said the reform will be especially beneficial for 60% of AARP members who are under age 65 and still in the workplace. Luby said 20% of Alaskans between 50 and 64 have no health insurance.
And in that group, they're the ones who are most likely to have some type of a health problem that may be associated with aging.
Luby says far too many elders think that long-term care, whether in a nursing home or at home, will be paid for by Medicare once they reach age 65.
Medicare doesn't. And because of that, this is one of the glaring holes that we still have in our health care system. The Medicaid program is the one that ends up picking up the tab, basically, for long-term care. And that's only after people have exhausted their own resources and spent down so that that they are now eligible for Medicaid.
He says nursing home care averages $400 to $500 a day in Alaska. Luby says perhaps surprisingly, the primary opponents of health care reform are AARP members.
Older people seem to be basically concerned about the fact that if everybody got health care, they were going to lose something from the Medicare coverage that they had. And frankly, they were susceptible to a lot of the rumors that were around health care. 30% of older people today still think that we have death panels.
Dr. Tom Hunt is the CEO for Physician Services at Providence Health and Services in Alaska. He says the rhetoric and scare tactics swirling around what should be serious, respectful dialogue about someone's final days has been unfortunate. His group wants to lead with a coherent approach to end-of-life discussions.
And we're hopeful that we'll be able to do a good job communicating that effort such that it's not about death panels, it's about compassion and respect. And let's not be disingenuous, too. It's about providing value for healthcare because we spend a lot of money inappropriately maintaining life when everybody else wanted to finish it. So I think we're going to try to lead with that so that we can make this about a values-based decision and not about death panels and denial.
The need for more physicians in primary care was also highlighted. Shelley Hughes is the Government Affairs Director for the Alaska Primary Care Association. She says in other countries, primary care is huge, specialized care is small, and patients have better outcomes. She says the U.S. government should invest in primary care and provide incentives for students.
They get in that third year of medical school, and all of a sudden they had a heart to do primary care. And then they start looking at their student loans, and they realize, I can make $600,000 as a dermatologist. I'm going to make $150,000 as a primary care doc. And they switch. And so now we have a very small fraction going into primary care. That, again, is another appropriate role of the government to provide some incentives to get folks into primary care, to allow the mid-level practitioners to work up to their full potential.
Other benefits touted by the panel were the elimination of insurance companies rejecting someone for a pre-existing condition. Lifetime caps for medical expenses were also eliminated under the reform package. Children with severe diseases, such as leukemia, were hitting those limits as early as age 12. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation recently received a higher bond rating due in part to its $5 billion in assets. The higher bond rating may mean millions of dollars in savings for the corporation, which finances housing programs. KNBA's Jocelyn Estes has more.
The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's bond rating was boosted from AA to AA+ by the S&P Ratings Services. Bond ratings reflect the corporation's overall financial health and credit worthiness. The higher the rating, the less interest AHFC pays when it borrows cash. Those savings add to the funds that go toward housing projects, energy and weatherization, and mortgage loans for Alaskan homebuyers. The corporation has long had solid collateral from federal agencies, insurance, and cash reserves backing its mortgages. AHFC Chief Financial Officer Joe Dubler says Alaska also has a low rate of mortgage defaults.
The mortgage delinquencies here at the corporation have actually been about normal. We're not experiencing the same problems that they're having in the lower 48. And we're looking pretty good coming into this legislative session.
Dubler says the reason the upgrade came now is that the state of Alaska's bond rating was upgraded in November, showing increased faith in its creditworthiness. Also, says Dubler, it helps that in 2003, the legislature adopted a plan that limits the transfer of income from the corporation to the state.
The relationship that we have with the state has always been the biggest concern that the rating agencies have had with us, and that clearly has improved over the last 15 years or so to the point where we have a very good working relationship with the state, and they're not trying to raid the corporation, and people aren't afraid they're going to raid the corporation. So that definitely contributed to it.
Dubler says the bond ratings upgrade is especially noteworthy because AHFC lost $10 million last fiscal year due to low returns from interest and investments. However, Standard & Poor's noted the corporation's strong, experienced management team, a team that Dubler says led swift and appropriate reactions to the losses. In Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Rasmussen Foundation is announcing a March 1st deadline to apply for Individual Artist Awards, which provides funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Learn more by participating in one of the informational teleconferences open to the public to be held the week of January 17th. Call 297-2882 or go online at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. Help manage subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide critical advice to the Federal Subsistence Board on the management of subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing on federal public lands. The deadline to apply is February 18th. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The state's Board of Fisheries sat down to work in Anchorage Sunday afternoon. The panel hears staff reports and public testimony on all proposals prior to deliberating changes in the Cook Inlet, Kodiak, and Chignik finfish fisheries. A number of proposals on this session's agenda deal with the rules governing the Pacific cod fishery in state waters in the Chignik area, which is located on the southern shore of the Alaska Peninsula. Richard Sharp, the mayor of the city of Chignik, says that many proposals submitted by the city and by the Chignik Marketing Association are aimed at bringing the city increased fish processing earnings. Several proposals would have the Board of Fish okay a reduction in the percentage of Pacific cod allowed to fishermen using jig gear while increasing the pot fishery share in the cod quota. Sharp says about 1 million pounds of cod is going unharvested because no jig fishermen are registering for the jig fishery in Chignik. The city has also requested that the jig allocation for Pacific cod roll over to all legal gear types by March 21st if no vessels using jigging machines have registered. Other proposals would limit the number of hooks used in jig gear. Jig fishing gear uses horizontal hooked lines for harvesting cod.
It's a very mobile fishery. Although you may anchor, you're not leaving the gear on the bottom as in longlining or pot fishing. The gear is very lightweight. It's got very low bottom impact.
Darius Kasperzak, a Kodiak jig fisherman, has been fishing Pacific cod for a dozen years. He says the jig fishery is the last open access fishery left.
Fishermen can get into it relatively cheaply compared to the other sectors, and it's about the only open access fishery left in the Gulf of Alaska, meaning as that you can still, for a minimal fee, you know, buy a vessel license and a permit and go fishing. It's not an expensive privatized or limited entry permit.
Since Chignik is a super exclusive zone, vessels registered elsewhere cannot fish Chignik waters. Casper Zach fishes elsewhere, although he says the lack of jiggers in Chignik is driven by a lack of buyers there. Mayor Sharp says lost harvest opportunity in Chignik state waters occurs when no one fishes the 10% jig gear allocation for Pacific cod. He says the fishery would be better served if the unused quota was rolled over early enough in the season to be targeted by other gear types. Frigid temperatures and sparse snow set a rough track for the 42nd annual Alcan 200, the longest snow machine road race on the continent. The ride took place on Saturday outside of Haines. Tara Bicknell reports.
The Alcan 200 racetrack starts at the Canada-U.S. border outside of Haines, Alaska, and runs through British Columbia before turning back at Desdiash Lodge in the Yukon Territory, totaling 155 miles of competitive, high-speed winter racing. But this year's conditions made the ride a little more difficult to stand than in recent years. Race organizer Karen Hess at the awards banquet Saturday night estimated at least 10 miles of snowless pavement along the course.
There were guys who actually were picked up and put on the lowboy that burned up their skis just from the friction. Really? Skis just melted. I mean, just because you have skis on your sled, you still need to. You put them on a highway and you got metal under them, which is carbides, you get friction. Pretty soon you just got sparks and it just gets so hot it melts the skis.
Temperatures surpassed 20 below zero Fahrenheit, causing some riders to nearly become frostbitten. It was the reason behind at least one racer scratching before the race ended.
This is the coldest we've had in several years. These guys had wind conditions up on the pass. At 75 mile, the wind was blowing across the highway so bad that, I mean, it was sometimes just, I mean, nothing but just snow blowing across the highway. When we were coming back, it was like that. So I know they have that to deal with.
And now, first overall, Jared Davey from Whitehorse. Yeah!
However, the overall winner, Jared Davey, traveled to the race from Whitehorse, where it was minus 40 the day before the race.
Well, I froze my fingertips. My body was warm. I was really good. But I froze my two fingers on my left hand, pretty solid, almost solid.
Davey's time overall was 1 hour, 33 minutes, and 28 seconds. The top average speed came in at 99.5 miles per hour this year, lower than in past years. Also down this year was the number of racers. Organizer Hess with the Chilkat Snowburners says it's one of the lowest numbers in recent years. Last year, 42 racers registered. This year, there were 25. In Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
Every January, many Russian Orthodox believers go starring for Russian Christmas, following a star from house to house, just as the three wise men followed a star to Bethlehem. But for some, that tradition is followed for 8 days by a much darker custom. KUCB's Ann Hillman went to the village of Akatan in the Aleutian Islands to find out more.
You had the net on, right?
A group of people dig through a pile of old clothes, looking for costumes.
Oh, I just put on a pair of big pants, stuffed them, make my legs look fat, and that's pretty much it.
What'd you put over your pants?
Some Spider-Man boxers.
Over his head, Matthew Breskin wears a pillowcase with a face drawn on it.
I just made a guy who made some eyes, nose, big goatee, big beard, some brownish hair, and that's pretty much it.
Others in the group wear massive dresses stuffed with pillows or long ponchos that hang to the floor. On their pillowcase masks, some draw slanted pink eyes and bizarre lips. Others have round, wide eyes. Each person puts gloves over their hands. Josie Schengen says they don't want to be recognized by anyone in their town of 90 people. They're going masking.
We are, I guess, following the Bible, and we're on a mission to try to find baby Jesus to kill him.
The old Russian tradition represents the Bible story of the Massacre of the Innocents, wherein King Herod gave orders to kill all of the young boys in Bethlehem in the hopes of killing the baby Jesus. In Akutan, they move from house to house, shuffling along the boardwalks that serve as roads. They whistle to warn people they're coming in. And then... the maskers who are dressed as men each choose a masker who's dressed as a woman, and they dance to polka music played from the CD player they carry with them. When the dance is over, they whistle to announce their exit and move on to the next house. Between each stop, Elder Eva Lott says they must count the number of people in their group.
But you always make sure when you go on masking, you always count who's all there with you. Make sure your group is with you. Sometimes you get another person, and they won't unveil themselves. Back in the olden days, there was elders here before us, and they used to say outside men. They were dressed like maskers, but they wouldn't take their mask off.
The outside man is the Aleut version of the hairy man, or supernatural wild man. Though the idea is creepy, some say that maskers aren't exactly.
You guys were funny.
But Vera Pelkey says it used to be different.
They used the buoys back then.
Buoys?
Buoys instead of cloth. They didn't have the cloth then. Mike Shelikoff, I remember, came in with a buoy in the old house, 1964. Well, that scared the heck out of us.
The maskers go from house to house for 8 nights. On the last night, people in town guess who is who. Lydia Vinsler says that in a small town, it isn't that hard, but you do have to pay attention.
After watching the people and try to see how they move and everything, and they finally get an idea by the last night, and they usually get them right.
But according to tradition, the maskers now have evil on them. So at midnight on January 19th, also known as Devil's Night in Accutan, Shengen says she and the other maskers go to cleanse themselves.
That's the night that we go and get holy water from the creek by the school. All the water's holy that night at midnight. And everybody who went masking that year, this year, also goes up and washes our face in it. I don't know, I always put some in my ears too, because hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. And a lot of people from town will come get holy water too.
Vinsler says the creek was blessed by an Orthodox bishop when the town was still young in the early 20th century. That way, if a priest couldn't get to the remote island by boat, the people wouldn't run out of holy water. However, the water is only holy on January 19th, which according to Russian Orthodox tradition is the day that Jesus was baptized in the River Jordan. Community members collect holy water that day to bless all of the rooms in their houses.
Especially if you had maskers in your house, I'd be blessing, really blessing.
And with the holy water, the houses are cleansed and ready for the blessings of the new year. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Tara Bicknell in Haines, and Ann Hillman in Akaton. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, and Lori Townsend from Anchorage. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works. When you file online for your PFD, you can donate to any of 40 Alaska organizations that provide health care services for those who might otherwise go without. Get more with your PFD when you pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation and Providence Health Services Alaska. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD. Paper applications are available at the same 270 statewide locations as last year. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.